Hello, my friends. Welcome back to the What If Project podcast. My name is Glenn, and this is episode 289. And today we're talking to Perdita Finn about her book, Take Back the Magic, Conversations with the Unseen World. My father passed away last March, and it was early in the morning. It was like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. And my mom and I were at the hospital, and we were with him in the room. And he was very much out of it with all the medicine he was on and the pain he was in. And I remember the nurses and the doctors kind of coming in, telling us there's nothing else they can do, and kind of telling us how the rest of the evening or next hour or so was going to unfold. And they kept saying things that, like, you know, he's got about, you know, we upped his morphine and he's got about, you know, 30 more minutes or in the next 20 minutes, this is what's going to happen. And, you know, then as it got closer, they said, we're going to give you some space. And everybody left the room. And I remember having this feeling that, like, this can't be it. You know, like, there's got to be, like, I have more things to say. And he's got more things to say to me. He's got more guidance, like, to give me. You know, like, this is all happening so fast. This is all so abrupt. Like, this can't be it. This can't be it. I remember just having this internal wrestling match that, like, it was like one of those hourglasses with the sand dropping through. And I just getting closer and closer and closer to the end. And there was nothing I could do about it. But I sensed it coming. And it was coming so fast. And there's got to be more. And so I read Perdita's book. And it spoke to the deepest hopes of my heart that my dad is still here and he's still offering guidance. One of the things she talks about in the book is that way back when they used to bury people, like, locally, like in your town. They still do, like, in a cemetery, but they also would bury people, like, in their backyards. And so, like, people would go out and they would talk, stand at the grave, and they would, you know, talk to their ancestors. They would receive guidance from their ancestors. This was like a common thing that, like, pretty much, like, everybody did. And for various reasons that she talks about in the book, a lot of it having to do with the church, you know, this was the kibosh was put on it. And so this book is about taking back your magic, taking back the magic, being able to converse, speak with those who have gone before us. And Perdita talks in the book about her own relationship with her father that was very rocky, and how after his passing, it has really experienced a lot of healing as she's been able to talk with, communicate, receive guidance from her father and share things, you know, with him. And it's not like Perdita's like a medium. It's not like, you know, it's nothing like that. This book is just, I didn't know what to expect when I read this book, but It was just what I needed to hear. And she talks in the book about like reincarnation, and that's something that's always confused me. And so I share with her both my confusion and my fear in this episode, and she speaks to both of those very, very well. But if you've lost somebody in your life and maybe you feel like they're around but you don't know really what to do with that, maybe like you grew up in the church and you were told that that's evil and demonic. We talk about that as well because that's what I was always taught. But maybe you feel that way. This book will help you, give you some fresh perspective. If you have questions about what happens when we die, this book will give you some very creative wonderings to wonder about. Really excellent book. I can't say enough about it. So anyway, I'm going to put the link to the book, to Perdita's work, in the show notes. Also in the show notes are links to my books, Rethinking Everything, Emerging from the Rubble, and also Patreon if you want to support the show. This has helped you at all, encouraged you, pushed you forward in your faith. You can go there to support the show on a monthly basis. And also, something new coming to the What If Project website probably next month. I will be talking about it probably in one of the intros to the podcast. But be on the lookout, whatifproject.net. I'll be searching there. There will be a new page popping up very, very soon. So anyway, all that to say, my friends, all the links are in the show notes. This is episode 289 with my friend Perdita Finn, who helps us take back the magic. Enjoy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today we are joined by a brand new guest who I'm really looking forward to talk to. Her name is Perdita Finn. She has written an amazing book called Take Back the Magic, Conversations with the Unseen World. And so Perdita, welcome to the podcast. I love your book, your work. I've really been looking forward to this.
Thank you for having me on, Glenn. It's a real honor to be here, and I'm really excited about talking with you.
Thank you. So before we get into your book, for listeners who aren't too familiar with you and your work, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Who are you? What sort of things do you do in the world? Tell us what we have to know.
Well, you know, it's so interesting the way we introduce ourselves, particularly in the LinkedIn climate. You know, somebody once said to me, you know, what are your credentials? In a course I was teaching about how to collaborate with the dead, and I thought, my credentials?
Credentials? What does that mean?
Credentials? I don't know. For over 40 years, I have been talking to and collaborating with the dead, and this was a very intimate, personal, spiritual journey. You know, I had a lot of spiritual yearning and questing. I've recently had a young astrologer tell me, I've never been into astrology. I'm 62, but finally I'm sort of opening up to it, because this astrologer said to me, did you know all your planets are in the eighth house of death? And I think at this age, I'm beginning to understand that the dead have been calling me my whole life. I can tell you where I went to college and jobs I've had and books I've written. I've been a writer my whole life. But my real calling has been from the dead, and they have asked me, called me to let people know they're there and that they want to help us, particularly at this moment of crisis for the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, they've done climate change before. They've done extinction before. And they have wisdom we can't even imagine to guide us through times that can often feel chaotic and confusing. Yeah. And they don't want us to be afraid.
So this has been part of your whole life.
My whole life.
Interesting, because I've talked to some people who, I don't know, they would categorize themselves as mediums, or, you know, other people say, just, you know, speak with the dead or get their guidance, whatever. But some people hasn't been part of their whole life journey. That's what fascinated me so much about your book, which we'll talk about in a minute, is how you could really see you tracing the patterns of this throughout the course of your life, which I thought was so interesting. How Monday morning quarterback, you can look back on your life and say, oh yes, right? There it is.
Well, I wanted to say that is the one advantage of being in my, you know, seventh decade, is right, that one can begin to do that. I think it's important to say that I'm not a psychic. I'm not a medium. I wrote a book with a psychic, an extraordinary woman who had to train herself to tell the living and the dead apart. I number among my friends many mediums and psychics. I don't see dead people. I don't hear their voices. But I have learned to have, as we all do, an intuitive relationship with those on the other side. And this is a kind, used to be for our ancestors, as I've discovered, a ubiquitous ability.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody could consult their ancestors. Everybody could be in conversation with those who had come before. And that guidance was essential for getting through the day and getting through life.
Yeah.
So what I do on the one hand is very ordinary available to anyone.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I've tried to show in the book. And I must say that I was lived in secret about all this for a long time. Mm. You know, I certainly didn't talk about it at the swim meet or the soccer game with the other parents.
Hey, Barbara, guess what? So your book, if you had an elevator pitch this book for us and just give us a quick synopsis, Take Back Your Magic, how would you describe it? Because what I love about the title is, or Take Back the Magic, I'm sorry, Conversations with the Unseen World. When I look at this title, it's almost like it's an invitation for me to come into something, like you just said, this isn't something just for a medium or a psychic or somebody like that, but this is something that you are inviting all of us, regardless of where we are in our lives, into. So share a little bit about what people can expect in this book.
The book tells the story of how I healed with my absolutely impossible father, who disinherited me in his will. After he died, my father and I got to know each other, and he began showing up for me, and we began doing the work of having a relationship together. And he really brought through a lot of miracles for me. And, you know, if I had to tell you, this is available to all of us. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about ancestral healing. And it has a tendency to make us feel burdened by yet another monstrous thing on our to-do list. In addition to picking the kids up, you know, from piano lessons, I've also got to heal all my troubled ancestors. You know what I mean? Like, and it is part of what capitalism does to us. It makes us feel exhausted and overwhelmed. And so then we got to buy another thing to try and make ourselves feel better. And in fact, my own very intimate experiences with the dead had shown me that the dead don't need healing. We do. And the dead are there to help us do that work. And in fact, they're even there to help us pick the kids up from the piano lessons. And, you know, they're there to help us with the most mundane, ordinary troubles of everyday life, as well as the big upset knots in our hearts. And we have access. We have access to magic and miracles, each and every one of us. Now I'm going. It's been a long ride up to the top of the Empire State Building on that elevator. So forgive me. My grandmother gave me the gift of gab. So what can I say?
No worries. I like it. I like it. No, I think that's such an interesting, you know, such an interesting way to describe it. Because when you think about like modern, like TV movies, it's always about the dead needing our help. Right. Because especially like with the crossing over piece and things like that, like, you know, there was that one show, I think it was, I don't remember what it was called, the ghost, Ghost Whisperer. And she would always have to help these spirits cross over to their side. Like they were begging for our help. And so there's part of me where that's how I've been conditioned to think about spirits, is they always need something from us. And your book really brought to light that, oh no, like they have something to offer us.
You know, it's very interesting to me to look at this burdensome relationship we have been given with the dead through traditional religious experiences. And not only burdensome, but also often terrifying. I mean, our media is filled with, you know, the hand coming up out of the grave that's going to pull us down, you know, the ghost of the little girl who's going to stab us in the middle of the night. I often say, I'm not frightened of the dead. I'm not frightened of any of the dead. I'm not frightened of the ghost of Hitler and Stalin. I'm frightened of the living. I'm frightened of the generals pushing the buttons for the bombs right now. I'm frightened of the CEOs making rational decisions in boardrooms right now that are hurting people. And one of the things that's fascinating to me, and I'm a student of history and paleobiology, is what happened to our relationship that was very wholesome and ordinary and ubiquitous for our ancestors when civilization got going. And, you know, religion is a recent invention, and it is an invention designed to reinforce power systems and systems of domination and control. You know, there's one God, you've got to believe our God, here's your creed, you know, all other gods are bad, right? You know, somebody, my daughter was saying, you know, what's magic? Magic is what the other team does, not what we do. You know, we may turn wine into water, but that's not magic. You guys are the wizards. You know what I mean? Like, so it creates, but one of the most fascinating things to me, and I've read a lot of feminist scholars, is that the thing that most got in the way of priests, and by priests, I'm talking about priests in all different religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, Christianity, Judaism, you know, Zoroastrianism. What got in the way of the priests consolidating their power was that ordinary people, pre-literate ordinary people, were used to consulting their dead for guidance. And you find letters early, like in the, you know, the 300s, from priests writing to their bishops saying, we can't get anybody in this village to listen to us. They'll just go to the graveyards. And so it was a really deliberate attempt to silence the dead to get people to listen to religious authority. And the other way you silence the dead is make them needy, right? And so we have this whole new culture growing up of ancestral healing that's sort of attached to our psychological culture, which is a really like, you know, like you're going to pay someone who's going to help you heal your dead. And you know what I mean? get caught up and listen to you, and you're going to be a whole system. And if you're good, you'll enter the program and you'll go through the steps and you can become an ancestral healer, and Amway wins. And and what happens, our ancestors did not live in a monetary economy. Mm-hmm. They lived in a prayer economy. Mm-hmm. And that they consulted their ancestors to find food, find shelter, get the fire going, know which herbs would bring healing to their family members. They went to the ancestors to meet up with another group so they could find somebody to love. You know what I mean? There weren't a lot of people around. You prayed to the dead, and the dead were the very ground beneath your feet. The dead were the dirt you walked over. They were the earth. They were the land. You came to a tree and you told the stories of the ancestors in that tree. And when you were there at that tree, you prayed to those ancestors who had had that story associated with them. You walked to the river, and there were stories about other ancestors at the river.
That's such a beautiful like description, because I mentioned you in our emails, but I grew up in a very conservative, fundamentalist, evangelical world. And any talk about the dead, any talk about, God forbid, communicating with the dead, like that was seen as demonic.
Right.
Anti-God, anti-Christ, you know, you might as well be sacrificing chicken blood on the altar, like worshiping Satan, because that's pretty much what it is. And so coming out of that world, like this is all new talk to me. But what I'm seeing is how fear-oriented all of that was, when in reality, there's really nothing to fear. And it makes me wonder, you know, like what were they trying to protect? And so when I read that part of your book where you talked about how the wives in the old days would go out to the graveyards, and they would, you know, they would communicate with the ancestors, and they would get guidance from them. Now, this was a real threat to the church leaders, because if you have a pastor or a priest or whatever who's trying to listen to the one true God and give that, you know, that guidance from that being, and you have all these other people who are out there listening to the ancestors and getting guidance from them, it makes it hard to build a system. It makes it hard to build institution when you don't have everybody who's in alignment with what this one voice is saying. And I thought to myself, like, looking back again, like Monday Morning Quarterback, along all those books I've read, all the lectures I've sat through, all the different things, it made so much more sense that, oh, there really is something on that side to protect, to make it look like this is all very dangerous and demonic and evil and things like that. So there's a lot of clarity.
You know, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. You know,
right. It's, yeah.
You know, I mean, I think one of the things that's really interesting too is that there was a 200-year period, you know, to look at Protestantism. You know, I just finished reading Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel about, you know, Thomas Cromwell and the Anglican Church. And on the one hand, you know, the deconstruction of the Catholic Church's power seemed like a good thing. On the other hand, they, you know, they threw away the good stuff and kept the bad stuff. You know, I mean, that's and what you see happen in the 200-year period after the Reformation is the absolute silencing of the dead. In fact, we talk about the European witch craze. We don't know how many people died in it. 80% of them were women. The men who died often tended to be their husbands, their lovers, their sons, and their allies. But what they were most often accused of was not midwifery or herbalism. They were accused of talking to the dead. And what we see is that desire to silence the dead, to literally create a terror campaign against these women. It's happening at the exact same moment of colonial expansion. It's happening at the same moment that the East India Company is going to be coming to the New World, torturing the native people, stealing their lands. I call it the great silencing, the silencing of women, the silencing of dead, and the silencing of the natural world, so that capitalism can emerge as the monolithic Sauron to take over the world. And what's the difference between a monologue and a conversation is, in a conversation, everybody, we're all just trying to be, we don't know how to have conversations anymore, right?
Yeah. Yes, it's an ongoing, it's a back and forth. It's not just a one speaking. Yeah. I think that's something that's lacking in the church, to be honest with you. I mean, again, going back to my own thinking about, you know, being a pastor, things like that, there's not
enough dialogue with the being. It's always about the monologue from the pulpit, you know, from what the preacher has to say that the preacher got from God and giving it to all the people. It's not really a back and forth thing.
You know, when I got for I, you know, I went through a lot of different religious experiences. I grew up in an atheist family. Their religion was psychoanalysis in the New York Times, but everyone's got a religion, you know. Let me tell you, it's a fundamentalism. It's hard to escape.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got converted to Christianity for about 15 minutes, and then I got involved in Zen Buddhism. And at first, what attracted me to Zen Buddhism was the koan, the question, the unanswerable question that provokes dialogue and conversation.
Yeah.
Of course, in the context of that patriarchal system, and that's a system where you pray to the patriarchs and people hit you with sticks if you make a noise, that... there is no conversation. It's a monologue from the master to the, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's a, I think in all of these religions, there are the strains of these lost tools we had for engaging with the other side. And
yeah.
it, and I don't want to ever throw out the good folk traditions.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also, you know, a lot of people I know who know a lot about prayer are involved in fundamentalist religious experiences. They often are very wise about prayer.
Yeah.
You know, so it's important to remember that there are people who've had experiences in all of these that have benefited them.
Yeah. That's right. And I think too, I mean, it's important to realize how wide the history of a lot of these faiths are, especially Christianity, because like again, was raised in a very narrow path to think this was the only way. This is the way it's always been since the days of Jesus. And now, thanks to this podcast and having so many different people on with so many different experiences, I'm like, oh, like the history of Christianity is so wide. And this one stream that I've been told has the corner marker on everything is really a relatively new stream to begin with. But some of the ancient streams are very esoteric. There's a lot of back and forth with the divine in there. And I'm realizing I can call myself a Christian, but not be the kind of Christian that I was brought up to be, or the path, I should say, that I've been traveling for so much of my life. Like, there's other streams for me to explore.
Yeah. I mean, my daughter has wrote a novel about, you know, Jesus and Mary Magdalene, Yeshua. And one of the things she was really fascinated by was the variations among the Judaism of Jesus's day.
Yeah.
There wasn't one monolithic Judaism.
Yeah.
There, you know, Nazarene Judaism was very different than the Temple Judaism.
Yeah.
And you know, what did it mean to be a wandering Magid? What did it mean to be a magician? And, you know, and how ubiquitous was devotion to Dionysus, for instance, in those areas where Jesus began teaching? And how often was he evoking not just the Old Testament, but the Eleusinian mysteries? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You go book, start looking at these things, and I often say that I live inside mysteries, that the thing that separates fundamentalism from the mystery religions is the I don't know.
Yeah.
Fundamentalisms of all kinds, and every branch of religion has its fundamentalist version, all have the answer.
Yep.
They know what's right, they know what's wrong. But the mystery cults of the Mediterranean, which were never written down, they invited us to step inside the great I don't know.
Yeah.
And what attracted me to koan study and Buddhism originally was that confounding I don't know. You know, I here, you know, if we think about our own lives, right? We don't remember much from before we were born. We don't know what's going to happen to us after we die.
Yeah.
And we're not really sure what happens to us when we're asleep. And we sit inside these lives surrounded by mystery, and our planet itself spins in a solar system that spins in a galaxy that's mostly dark matter. 80% of the cosmos is dark matter. And we don't know what dark matter is. So, you know what I mean? Like, wait a minute, okay, wait a minute, stop there. You know, I mean, even science can become a fundamentalist religion if it stops being able to say, I don't know.
Yep, that's right. And it's funny because I thought, I mean, again, coming from that fundamentalist background, we had all the answers. I studied apologetics, systematic theology. Like I prided myself on having all of the answers to the questions, but now I'm in this place having, been multiple years now into like deconstructing and rethinking a lot of that stuff. I thought that mystery was going to be a scary thing. I thought not having the answer was going to be a horrifying feeling, but it's been such a freeing feeling for me to be able to embrace the words, I don't know, but I wonder if, and to have that, let my mind just kind of go to all these places, especially having a daughter, she's six. She's asking a lot of questions about God these days, and especially after my father passed away in March, like asking a lot of these questions. And in the past, I would have felt like I had to have answers to her questions. She's only six. She's relying on me to have all the answers. But now I'm like, she asked me a question. I'm like, I don't know. What do you think? And then, then that kind of spins it back to her and lets her, oh, my daddy doesn't know. Well, what do I think? And then she shares what she thinks. I'll be like, that's a pretty interesting point. Maybe this. And then we kind of go back and forth. She's only six, but we're having these amazing conversations where we're both embracing the mystery of not knowing. And then we end up going, okay, let's go have a snack. That's the end.
It's always the best solution to every problem. But I have to
Exactly.
talk about being only six and not knowing, because one of the other things about the mystery religions is they're often what we do know are the realities of the natural world. I often say I prefer ecology over theology, right? Theology asks me to believe things for which there's no evidence, but ecology says the moon gets full and then it wanes, then it waxes and it wanes, and the tides go out and the tides come back in, and the seasons turn and the world turns, and most everything operates in the natural world in these spiral patterns of return, return, return. And for our ancient ancestors, among indigenous peoples all over the world, an experience, not a belief, but an experience of reincarnation and rebirth is ubiquitous. And Tyson Yunkaporta, the Aboriginal elder, writes in his beautiful book, Sand Talk, that in his culture, your great grandmother is also your child. So when you sit down with your 6-year-old daughter, you're also sitting down with your elders. And so it changes our relationships. A dominance hierarchy says, you're the patriarch of your family, and your little girl better pay attention to you and listen to you, and you will indoctrinate her and teach her how to behave. And a more fluid understanding of the ecology of souls says, who are you? What do you know? What do you need to tell me? Why have you come to me? How do you want to teach me this time around? Let me tell you, I got two wild ones. And my husband used to say, his Zen teacher talked about the death of the ego, but he'd never been a father. And I think if we treasured our young people as our elders, and we treasured our elders as our elders, right? They're the two groups of people who are closest to the veil, our old ones and our little ones, are the ones we push away from everyday life. We got to keep them close. They have the guidance we need.
Speaking of guidance, in the book you have this quote that I wrote down. I want to read it for our listeners. I want to ask you if you could respond to it. But you say that the dead are our allies and our teachers. They will guide us to the particular practices and devotions that are suitable for each of us. The dead lead us to the teachings that we need. So if the dead, like children, are our guide, they're leading us to these practices. Can you give us some examples of what that means, especially to somebody who grew up in my kind of world, and this is all very new language to them? When you talk about the dead leading us to different practices that we need, what does that look like? What's that mean?
Can talk about what it looks like in my life,
Yes,
and everyone
please.
else is going to be different, right? So, for instance, behind me, you'll see an ancestor altar. And I began putting my dead photos of them, objects for people I don't have photos, and giving them space to gather in my home. And there is in my dining room space for the dead to gather. But when I teach one of my workshops, I say to people, there are a lot of different ways of making space in your home for the dead to gather. And different cultures have different ways and traditions of doing this. And so things are going to feel right to you that might not feel right to me. So for one person, it's about making a book of ancestors. For another, they want to do it outside. They want to have a shrine outside rather than indoors. For somebody else, this is something they only set up once a year, right? For, you know, in many cultures, you always at every meal set a plate for the dead to eat. And that becomes the daily way of inviting the dead into your home. So there are a lot of different ways. I don't want to like dictate this is the way we do it. What I want, because I don't know. I want to say this is how I'm doing it. What are you doing? And one of the things I find so fascinating in these courses I teach is every time people come up with new things to do. For some people, it's not about having a physical space. It's about having a designated time where they're singing with their ancestors, for instance, or dancing with them. And so I think one of the things I love about ecology is nature, the natural world is always wanting diversity. Nature doesn't create one beetle. It creates a million different kinds of beetles. Yeah. It's fun to make beetles, apparently. You know what I mean? Like, we don't want just one. We want a lot of them. Right. We don't want just one kind of life. You know, the monotheistic impulse is to create one crappy apple that we all have to get at the grocery store, right? But the natural way is to create a diversity of apples. And so how do we allow that kind of ecological generative diversity to flourish in our lives? And that's what I think the dead and the natural world teach us how to do. You don't have to do it like me for me to feel safe.
I think that's really good. My daughter loves the movie Coco, the Pixar movie.
How many times have I seen it?
Yeah, we've seen it so many times. And so this year she said, she was talking about Coco and she said, let's celebrate the Day of the Dead. And so I'm like, I know nothing about it other than Coco, you know, and so did a little Google searching and things like that. And I recently had picked up your book. I don't remember if it was before or after, but anyway, I was thinking, okay, well, let's do something. So we have that, there's a table behind me back there. And she said, let's put some things on there that grandpa really liked. And so he loved his coffee, his Dunkin' Donuts coffee. So she drew a picture of a Dunkin' Donuts cup and we cut it out and we put it on the table. We put a picture of him on there. And then she wrote like a note that said like, grandpa, I miss you and I love you. And I put a couple of things on there. And then we stood there the night, like before the, whatever the night is before the Day of the Dead, we stood there and we talked to grandpa for a couple minutes and we left the lights on there. And then we went to bed and it was like this very precious moment, but she led us to that practice. And
she knew how to do it.
Yeah,
she knew exactly what to do.
Yeah, and then my dad loved being outside and, you know, working outside in the lawn. So in my shed, I put a picture of him up on the cabinets around all of his tools that he gave to me. And we have wind chimes out there and they're always clanging and blowing. Even when there's no wind blowing, the wind chimes are out there making noise. And when I'm mowing the lawn, I'm out there thinking of him, you know, and I go in there to get a drink and, you know, there's this picture right there. So for me, like, that was a practice that I felt that I was led to.
Your ancestor altar.
Yeah.
There it is. And you know, our ancestors didn't have photographs, but they had objects, you know, saints, relics and icons and pictures and memento mori, you know, a lock of hair would frequently be something from an ancestor. But one of the things I often like to think about is when you're doing an ancestor practice like that with your daughter, imagine your daughter doing that as an old grandmother with her granddaughter, telling her about your father, Jim, telling her about his tools and his love of Dunkin' Donuts, and always saying, like, you know, when Jim shows up for you in those wind chimes, make sure you get him a little bit of Dunkin'. You know what I mean? Right. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and imagine that granddaughter doing it with her granddaughter and saying, we don't really remember who Jim was, but he drank the black drink.
Right.
And Jim will show up. Jim is the great ancestor who shows up for you.
That's right.
And then three generations beyond that, his name will have disappeared. Yeah. And it's the grandfather who loved the black drink who speaks to you with the wind.
Yeah.
Our ancestors didn't have gods and goddesses. They didn't have saints and angels. they had their beloved on the other side. And we were always changing places, always coming back and returning to each other, always guiding each other and helping each other. And it was, we always belonged. When we belong to the dead, we belong to our own souls again.
So what can you tell me then, speaking about this coming back, being here, going back, coming back again, what can you tell me about reincarnation? Because you talk about this in your book, and I've read about it in other places, and I'm going to be honest with you, I'm confused and I'm scared. So I'm going to share both with you.
Your honesty.
Exactly. So first, okay. my confusion is, and maybe it's just because I'm misunderstanding what it is or what different faiths have taught about it, but if it is real and there is such a thing as reincarnation and we're able to communicate with our dead ancestors, like how does it work? Because I would think, like, if my dad, for instance, was reincarnated, then he wouldn't be able to offer guidance anymore because his soul has maybe gone to be someone or something else. Like, how can someone be reincarnated and yet still be able to offer guidance? Is that the mystery of it all? Or,
well, let me offer some examples from the natural world again. Let's see what we look like in ecology. But I want to think about two things. One, we tend to think as patriarchal civilized people in straight lines. Mm-hmm. We think of time as a straight line, the beginning, the middle, the end, the past, the present, the future, right? Mm-hmm. And these lines of domination and these simplistic lines of power are not what we see in the natural world. Mostly what we see are circles, orbit, ellipses, spirals. This is the image that we're being given. And in fact, you know, you look at our most ancient ancestors and what were they drawing? They were drawing triple spirals. Mm-hmm. They were recreating those images of circles over and over again to try and understand where they were and what was happening to them. I'm going to make your head hurt for a minute.
Okay.
Science, non-fundamentalist scientists tell us that an electron can be in two places at once.
Mm-hmm.
Same electron, two different locations.
Yeah.
Bad idea.
Yeah.
The other thing the scientists tell us is that time and space are not linear. They're folded over each other, like origami, like you were folding a letter to put it inside an envelope. So that, how does that work? That's going to make my head hurt.
Right.
But what I can experience, we all experience this, and I'm going to tell you where we experience it.
Mm-hmm.
You arrive in a place you've never been before, and you know you've been there.
Mm.
You meet someone you've never met before, and you go, don't I know you?
Mm-hmm.
Even in our dreams, when we let loose of the constrictions of linear time, how often do we wake from a dream and say, well, in the dream, I was in my mother's house, but my mother's house was actually in like an Italian village,
all the time,
which was
yeah.
actually in Africa,
right.
in a world I don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
but yet it felt so familiar.
Exactly. Right. And we kind of occupy those paper folds in our dreams.
Yeah.
But let me give you a way to think about reincarnation that might be even, people often find helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of embroidery as a child. I was a nerdy little girl. I never did any sewing and embroidery, if anyone's listening. My husband is actually a brilliant sewer and does all the sewing in our family. I'm a terrible, but I don't have the patience he does. But if you've sewn ever a stitch, imagine your soul, not as a coin or a pearl, but as a thread. Imagine it as a gold thread, a red thread, a blue thread, a green thread. And imagine that thread coming up through the cloth and going back down, going up through the cloth and going back down. Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, rebirth, death, rebirth, death, rebirth, death. And now there are a lot of stitches across that cloth, right? Each of those stitches is a life, but all the thread is one thread. I can pull on a stitch. If I pull on a stitch in one place, it'll set that cloth to moving in a particular way. If I pull on the stitch way back at the beginning, it sets the cloth moving one way. If I pull on the stitch very close to where I'm sewing, it moves the cloth in a different way. Each of those stitches is an incarnational experience we've had. Right? So that your father, Jim, will always be present to you as Jim. And he will be present to generations in your family, right? As I described him, loved and honored for generations in your family. But your father will have other stitches. And who knows? You may encounter someday a little boy or a little girl or even a raccoon and go, oh my God, I know who you are. You know, the job of elders in ancient cultures was to recognize the return of people. Who are you? You know, in my book, Take Back the Magic, I talk about some of the traditions I came through as a little girl that terrified my atheist father. And rather than questioning and exploring those traditions with me, he tried to suppress them and help me forget them. And a lot of our educational system is about making people forget who they've been and where they come from. I know with my own children, I still do. I listen to the things they're telling me so that I know how to help them claim their gifts in this life. You know, how do we know who we are? We know from our terrors and our fears who we are. You talked about fear and reincarnation. Here's the one thing about reincarnation. You died in all your past lives, and here you are. You came
still here. Still kicking.
Still kicking. But we have trauma. Trauma's real. And as civilized human being, trauma's real. But we also have treasures. We have gifts from past lives that we want to claim. And how do we claim the treasures and the gifts? You know, my son, when he was a little boy, when he was about 10, he's starting to learn about history, right? He decided that the greatest atrocity at age 10 the world had ever seen, had ever known, no, was not the Holocaust, not the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima, not this genocide or that war. He decided the great horror of all of humanity was peculiarly, I mean, it was a horrible thing, but the rape of Nanking, which was when the Japanese came into Nanking and invaded mainland China and copying the Nazis, you know, machine gun men into ditches, you know, raped the women, murdered them, enslaved people, and then starved people to death. And the starvation was supposed to be terrible. And the stories that people who survived the rape of Nanking tell about what people will do and who they will become when they're starving to death is terrifying and terrible. And so we've always just kept our eyes and ears open to this. My son is driven to be a farmer in this life. He is driven. He says the only thing people should think about is food sustainability in their communities. It's the most important issue. And he gets very adamant about it. No one's thinking about this.
Why doesn't everybody think about this? What's the matter with you?
So he went to go train at this farm outside Boston, right? And he wanted, and he's ultimately become the manager of this big organic farm, and he's learned a lot. And I'm very proud of him. But part of his job was one of the ways they support this permaculture farm is they have stores in Boston, high-end stores. And so he was sent to go work and run one of the stores for a couple of months to learn how it worked. And it turned out it was most of the customers were Chinese immigrants. And he found himself in conversations all day long with these old Chinese women about food and cooking and growing food. And my husband and I said it was like the cosmos. He has a deep, deep connection to an experience and a culture that's really driving and informing him in this life. And my job as his parent is to recognize that, not necessarily to like figure it out and who was he? And do you know what, I mean?
Yeah.
We get very capitalist and consumerist about reincarnation.
Yeah.
I often say to people, think about third grade.
Yeah.
What were you? How many days of third grade do you actually remember? Three, four? But you learn to read and write. You learn to do your times tables. You learn so much. And we are making use of those gifts and experiences, even if we don't remember them. And so what I, the ancient mystery cults of the Mediterranean, the Eleusinian mysteries, the mysteries of Isis and Osiris, were all focused around reincarnation. And living inside the mysteries of who we've been, who we are, and who we might become.
Well, that definitely answers my question, because it make a lot more. The thread piece that you mentioned helps bring a lot of those questions I had together, because that makes it seem also makes it seem a little bit less scary from what my fear is, which I'll share with you.
What
I'll
is your fear?
I'll share with you next. Well, my fear, if I could be really transparent with you, and again, maybe this comes from my misunderstandings or things I've heard about reincarnation, in my evangelical upbringing and studying like other religions and things like that. So if this is incorrect, please guide me to the proper understanding. But like, for instance, like I love my wife, right? I love my daughter. And the thought of closing my eyes here for like the last time, and then eventually opening them in like a new body where I perhaps won't be very conscious of my family anymore, and also have zero control, right? Because, and especially in our Western culture, we like to have control, but have zero control over circumstances that I might be born into. So for instance, maybe born into an abusive family or something like that. Like, that gives me a ton of anxiety. And I think it was in your book, but maybe it was a different book. I don't remember. I think it was your book, but there's a story about a certain culture where it's believed that babies come out of the womb and they're crying because their soul is like letting go of loved ones from a previous life. And it was your book. For me, like, I read that, I'm like, that sounds awful. it sounds like such a cruel way for the universe to be set up. And I'm like, I don't want that to be true. But perhaps there's something I'm not grasping, because it's a really real fear. Like, when I think about it, my heart starts to race. I actually get really nervous. I'm like, I really hope that this isn't the way it all works out.
Len, you're talking about love.
Yeah.
Power of love, and how much love hurts. And love hurts because we don't ever want to be separated from those we love. And your heart hurts because your dad died. And I mean, he's going to still be with you in those wind chimes and as you work and as you raise your daughter. But will you get to be with him again and be friends with him again and bodily companions again?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we all return to each other. That is the thing. Love is what guides us back to each other. Love is the magnet. My book is about my husband and me finding each other lifetime after lifetime, about our children finding us lifetime after lifetime. My prayer for my husband and I've been married 30 years, and I'm already in a panic, like, oh my gosh, there's not enough time.
Yeah,
we love each other so much. I love my children so much, like, that my prayer with my husband in my next life is we get to meet when we're teenagers.
Yeah.
<That'd be> fun. That much love in teenage bodies. Oh my gosh.
Right.
You know? So no one's ever lost to us.
Yeah.
In this world, no one ever goes anywhere. Now, we return to each other in different ways. You know, you talked to me, if it's all right, if I mention,
please,
about having three fathers, a biological father, a stepfather, and a step-stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
We all have many fathers and mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And those mothers and fathers come back to us in different ways.
Mm.
I don't know that I've always been my children's mother. Maybe in some lifetimes I've been their teacher.
Mm.
You know, there's a beautiful Buddhist folktale, and it comes from a tradition older than Buddhism, of the Buddha being reborn as animals to feed people. Reborn as a deer to feed a starving traveler. Reborn as a rabbit and throwing himself in a fire to feed a family.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're reborn as animals to feed those we love. And, you know, sometimes we're reborn as trees to keep them dry and shelter them. Sometimes we're reborn as their teachers. Sometimes we're reborn as their children. I had an incredible experience, I'll tell you. You know, my book is about healing with my father, right? And we had some work to do. And So like I got to the
it's
end
a
of the
little bit,
book.
it's a little bit.
Like, oh, we're good, right? Like dad and I are good. And I feel like I wrote the book with him and we wrote the book together and I blow him kisses all the time. And I feel really happy with my dad. And then about a month ago, I had a dream and I was standing in a field. And my parents, who were divorced in life, were both there together. And they came up to me. I've never experienced them together in a dream. They said to me, "We would like to be your parents again." And in my dream, I went, oh, really? Oh, no. And I woke up. like, and I was sitting there in my bed. And I was like, I mean, I've forgiven them.
Yeah.
I'll be your parents. I'll be your friends. I'll be your siblings. But you're going to be my parents again? I don't know. I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I can go through that again.
Right.
Glenn. I have a sister. She's 7 years older than me. She ended up on dialysis a year ago. Full kidney failure. And it's been a really scary, hard year. You know, she's been in and out of the hospital and ambulance visits. And dialysis is a really ugly experience. I mean, it is not a fun time. And I have prayed my heart out to my parents about her health and well-being because I love her so much. And I put each of my parents on her kidneys, and she still ended up in dialysis. The day after I had this dream, my sister called me. She has been taken off dialysis. Her kidneys have completely healed. Her nephrologist is writing a paper about what a miracle she is.
Wow.
And I knew at that moment that was my parents' way of saying, we can heal anything. We can heal our relationship. And I said to them at my ancestor altar, of course, I'll be your child again. Thank you. Thank you for being my parents again.
Wow.
We all grow and change. And as to fears, we do fear leaving each other. You know, I love my children so much. I quit sugar 2 years ago. I got sugar sober. And it's because I want to be here as long as I can with my kids, right?
Yeah.
I really, and my husband, you know what I mean? Like we want to be, we want as much time as we get. But I also know, and I say to my children, I'm going to die. Everybody dies. There's no exception. No one gets out of this alive. And if I die, when I die, it's because there's more that I can do from you, for you from the other side than I can do here. So just know that I'm still there.
Yeah.
I've got you. I love you.
Yeah. That's such a beautiful promise too, because again, you know, coming from that linear thinking, there's a beginning and there's an end, you know, and for me, again, in my life brought up, it was you die and you either go to heaven or you go to hell.
Like a conveyor belt, right?
Yeah, exactly. One way or the other is the escalator going up or going down. And then you're awaiting this time, like you're in heaven. You hope to get to heaven and you're going to wait for this time where Jesus is going to return and, you know, redo the whole world. But in that meantime, you're up there partying while your family's down here doing whatever they're doing. And, you know, there's really no interaction there. So it's very final. But I love this.
It doesn't make sense to me. Like, here's the thing I don't understand about heaven. This I never understood about heaven. If you're a good person who goes to heaven, wouldn't you be tortured with worry about the people in hell? Wouldn't you be like on the water brigade down to hell?
I would think so.
Right? Like the good people, like who are those assholes up in heaven having a good time while people are suffering down in hell?
What kind of jerks are they? Right?
I don't want anything to do with those guys.
Yeah. That confused me so much as a kid, because I remember, you know, we in sixth grade, we were talking about the book of Revelation and the rapture, you know, how we're going to be taken away. And I would have nightmares as a kid, literal nightmares, wake up crying because I would have these dreams that like I was being taken up to heaven. But my parents, who believed the wrong things, you know, they were going to be left down here. And while I'm being pulled up, everybody's partying and having a good time. But I was saying, how could I possibly have fun when the ones I love are down there being tortured. And then I would wake up from the dream. And I remember asking like my teachers this, like, it doesn't make any sense to me. And the answer was, well, we have to have faith that that's the way that it works out, and one day we'll understand. I'm like, but that doesn't make any sense to me.
It doesn't make any sense, and it makes no sense from a perspective of love. It makes a
None.
great, what it's really about is systems of fear and domination and keeping people frightened. But, frightened people are dangerous people. And I think we see that more and more in the world we live in, right? People who are frightened hurt each other. People who are frightened to drop bombs on each other. And people who live inside that loving space of the great I don't know want to invite everybody to sit down on the ground and have a conversation, because we're probably all each other's mothers and fathers. And it might be nice to begin to remember that.
That's right. That's right. So good. All right, last question for you. What is your advice to somebody who's listening to our conversation? They're going to get your book. They're going to read about your story, and they want to dabble, so to speak, in this world, and really start to have conversations maybe with their ancestors, things like that. But I mean, they're living life. They're working a 9-to-5 job. They're raising their kids. They're paying the mortgage. They're doing the things. They're exhausted at the end of the day. What does it look like to begin to dabble in this stuff without getting overwhelmed? Because for me, again, with all the books behind me, I like to understand things. I like to dive in. I like to master things. I got in the tarot a couple of years ago, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna pick this up like that. And it's like, I still have no idea what I'm doing, because it's such new language. It's such a mystery. And so how do you bring that into this typical person living their life?
Really simply, really slowly. And what I recommend is that don't take any of this on faith or feel talk yourself into gymnastics of belief, but let it become real for you this way. Every one of us has got headaches. It to be a modern person is to have a lot of headaches. Can I get a human being on the phone? Can I solve this problem with the health insurance company? Can my car not need $1,000 of work? Can I, can my tax bill not kill me? Can I, can this test turn out to be negative? Can my kid like her teacher at school? I mean, we have a list. I am an Olympic class worrier and fretter, so my list is 10 million long miles long. But start with one thing on that list and turn it over. Give it to someone you trust on the other side to solve for you. When I need to get a human being on the telephone, I often call. My father was a doctor, and he had this secretary who managed one secretary for the whole building of all the doctors. Remember those days? And she did all the appointments, all the insurance, all the everything,
Everything.
and she babysat me.
Oh man.
Okay, because my
I
whole thing
already
is
got a
like,
headache just thinking
now,
about
she was amazing. Her name was Ruth Nelson, and she's a great saint. She has to be remembered as a great saint. She had great bouffant hairdo, and nails were perfect. Just so you can, when I need to get a human being on the phone, I ask for Ruth's help every time. My daughter today is having this problem with her garbage pickup, and I've got Ruth on it. Like, Ruth, can you
Take care of
solve
it,
the
Ruth.
bureaucracy of the garbage pickup? It's making me crazy. So start with something small. And when you get an ordinary, everyday miracle, give them something else to do. I begin my day, Glenn, 40 years into doing this. My husband and I, our kids are grown. We lie in bed and we fret and we worry about our children. I hate to tell you this, but it never ends. And we turn over our worries to the other side. Friend just got diagnosed with cancer. We turn it over to a team of, healers and doctors on the other side. Our son is looking for a new job, and we have a whole team on it. Our daughter is trying to date on Tinder, and my God, we have armies of the dead on that problem. I
Everybody.
mean, so I published a book, and I have a marketing team from my publisher. I also have a marketing team on the other side. And so all of my worries, I feel supported. I talked about that thread as a weaving, but we are woven by the dead and held in that fabric. We're not little beings floating off in space by ourselves. We're woven together. And you can begin that weaving with one little miracle. Ask for help. See what happens.
Yeah.
Do it again.
Wow. Wow. So good. I have so many more questions, but we are out of time. Real quick, where can people go online to find you and interact with your work? Is there anything out there you want to share with people or invite them into?
TakeBackTheMagic.com is my website, and you can find out about all the courses and workshops I offer to help you learn how to do this and have some fun with it. I offer a lot of different ways to help people access the miracles that are available to them. Take Back the Magic is the name of my Substack. And if you come and join my Substack, I do a lot of writing. I'm always writing more books. You know, you work with the dead and it turns out they got a lot to say. And so I'm writing all the time.
Right.
But I also offer a monthly Zoom conversation about working with the dead through my Substack. So for $10 a month, you get all my writing and you get a conversation with people all over the world talking about working with the dead. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, Perdita Finn. You have to follow me on Facebook because I got too many people or something, but I'm there and I really am. I do interact with people a lot and I'm very active in those places because I really want to change the conversation.
Yeah,
I really want us to feel less frightened and have more fun.
That's right. That's right. Well, you're doing it. You're creating a safe place that's much less scary than many of us were brought up with. So thank you. Thank you You're for welcome. Your work. And thank
Glenn,
you for your time.
Thank you. What a joy it's been to be with you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.